welcome to PCB Chat. I'm Mike Buto, editor of PCDNF and Circuits Assembly Magazines. My guest today is Bill Cardoso, president of Creative Electron. Creative Electron designs and manufactures X-ray inspection systems for the electronics industry. Welcome to PCB Chat, Bill.
How you doing, Mike?
Great, thanks. I appreciate you taking the time today to talk with us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Bill, you came to electronics in what I would call perhaps a non-traditional way, meaning you didn't come directly to the industry out of school, but rather by way of some very interesting stepping stones. Could you tell our listeners a bit about that?
You're right. I think non-traditional ways is a good way to put it. Right out of college, I went to college in Brazil. So right my last semester in college, I was recruited by the U.S. Department of Energy to work in nuclear energy research and high energy physics. Right upon graduation, I moved to Chicago to work at Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. And that was, the first 10 years of my career after college. At Fermi Lab, we did a lot of my job. Towards the end of my career there, I was head of the electronic systems engineering department. So we designed some very expensive, very complex systems to look for atomic subparticles, those very tiny pieces of matter that would help us understand how was the universe formed, what's dark matter, where did we come from, how was the universe a few femtoseconds after the Big Bang. So those are the big questions that we were asking and trying to answer at Fermilab. And that was my job, was to design and build this very sophisticated cameras that would then look for this small subparticles that would, basically looking for the pieces of the puzzle, right, to put this whole, explain some of these big theories. And one of the experiments that I worked on in my early days eventually was used to find the Higgs boson, which got a lot of publicity last year. And the Higgs is one particle people call the God particle, because it explains a lot of where dark matter comes from, what is dark matter, things like that. So that was my background before joining the SMT industry. And I agree with you, that's not where usually people come from to work in our, amongst our colleagues.
And you were working toward your PhD during that time as well, correct?
Correct. So during that time, one of the great things of working for the U.S. government is, the ability to pursue academic endeavors. So I did part-time. I worked on my master's, my PhD, and also an MBA while we're working for the U.S. government. And a great opportunity, and one that I really, really appreciate and I'm very thankful for.
In my spare time, I cut the lawn. I think I have it a lot easier than you did. So while you were at Fermilab, were the buffalo still roaming around the center of the expanse?
It's very good. They're actually bisons, not buffalo.
Bisons. Okay.
And
sorry.
Yes, they are still. Yeah, it's the only place in the Midwest you can find bisons roaming freely. There's a very it's great to know that. But Fermilab has a farm, and bison are, we can see them being born, and it's a beautiful process. I highly encourage people to go visit the facility. In the early days, there were actually barbecues of bisons once in a while, but that, we don't do that anymore. Those are the early days.
Yeah, just stay out of the way of the particle accelerator, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's three stories down underground, so you're safe.
So how did you go from Fermi to forming Creative Electron?
So at the end of my tenure at Fermilab, as I said, I was leading this amazing group of engineers and scientists developing these high-end projects. But the high physics world and the nuclear research world got to a point today where these projects are massive, right? We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And as a result, things take time, right? So in your career, you might spend 15, 20 years before actually building something. And, I was in my late 20s and really I was excited about building things, right? So I was almost done with my MBA, and I thought I really wanted to start my own company. When I was in Brazil, I started my own company when I was probably 14, 15. I was still in high school, and it was a lot of fun. I was working back in my garage, and eventually, before coming to the U.S., I actually sold the company. But anyway, so I missed that, that skunk works mentality, that, entrepreneurial blood was still flowing strong in my veins. So I actually got a job to work at a small company here in San Marcos, California. I moved to California February of 2007. The owner of the company that had hired me to work with him passed away a couple of months later, which, it was a heart attack and very, very unfortunate and very, very sad story. But I ended up staying with the company for a little longer. I left, started Creative Electron in my garage again. So had a very interesting flashbacks of the early days when I was a teenager starting a company in my garage. So I started Creative Electron in my garage again. And 3 months after starting Creative Electron, I had an opportunity to buy that company I was working for prior. So that's when Creative Electron moved out of my garage to San Marcos. And that's where our first offices. And the growth started. And it's a funny story because I remember that, when I started my garage, right, I'm by myself, and there's not a lot of people know, but the U.S. government has this great program called SBIR, Small Business Initiative Research. So these are grants that U.S. government gives to small business who have innovative ideas on how to solve problems from military to aerospace to a National Science Foundation types of problems. That's how I started Creative Electron. So I applied for a grant with Homeland Security, right? And it was the first grant that I wrote. Again, when I was with the government, I used to review those grants. But now on the other side of the equation, it's actually much harder, to write them from scratch. So I had written this grant to solve a gamma ray spectrum problem for the U.S., for the Department of Homeland Security. The program, just in a few seconds, you have these big containers, right, shipping containers that come in and out of the country. The Homeland Security is especially interested in algorithms, right, software that would allow them to help operators of these, they run these big machines that x-ray cargo containers to find for illicit materials, right? Dirty bombs and things like that. So that was the first grant, and I wrote it. And, I was surprised when we actually were approved, right? And I got a call from the fellow who'd be our program manager for Homeland Security. And he calls me and says, Bill, congratulations. We're heading to San Diego in a couple of weeks. So we want to have a kickoff meeting for this program at your company, right? And I'm on my kitchen table, right, by myself, and then thinking, oh, wow, this got serious really fast. So that's when, you know, about the same time the acquisition of this other company happened, we were able to just, you know, having that, we were able to have the kickoff meeting at, you know, some professional office instead of my kitchen table.
Well, even though you've left the garage and the kitchen, I understand that you do all your development and manufacturing still here in the United States. What led you to that decision?
You know, that's a very good question. And I'm actually surprised how often people ask me that. You know, I feel sometimes like a unicorn because, you know, people look at me with surprise and say, why do you manufacture in the U.S.? The bottom line, Mike, is that I have a lot to give back to this country that adopted me, right? I mean, I've already spent as much time here than I've spent in Brazil in my lifetime. So, and I know, you know, it might sound corny, but I'm a big believer. I think, you know, to make things in the U.S. have a huge value. So that's the core, right? I make it here because we can still be profitable and I can still pay the, you know, the bills and keep manufacturing here in the U.S. We don't make as much money as we could, you know, by going overseas, but we make enough, you know, to make a living, a reasonable living for everyone who works here with us in San Marcos. There are also, we have a very tight team. From the design of our cabinets to our software development team, and having everyone under one roof, right, from R&D to development to manufacturing to software to technical support, helps a lot to make sure that we learn fast, right? So whatever problems we ship can be not only solved in the field, but it can be feedback to manufacture and design so future machines don't have the same problem. And also, you know, keeping that cohesive supply chain allows us to, for example, offer our customers a three-year warranty, which is unique in the industry, right? A three-year bumper-to-bumper warranty on our machines because we have so much control on everything we do, right? We had an interesting situation in 2015. So from 2015 to 16, we doubled the company in revenue and the number of machines we shipped. From 2016-17, we doubled again. And 2017, the facility we were here in San Marcos, our building was just, we're just bursting through the seams, right? You know, to move one crate in the warehouse, we had to move five other crates to reach, you know, we're building Tetris every day. So at that inflection point, right, we had an option. We can just say, you know what? X-ray cabinets are big, right? There's no way to make a pocket-sized X-ray machine. Those are big cabinets. They're heavy. So it takes real estate space, right? There's no other way around it. So when it came time to expand and plan for doubling the company again, we had a couple of options, right? We can either move and outsource manufacturing of those cabinets overseas, right? So we can stay in same footprint because, you know, we basically buy almost finished goods from overseas and we just bolt things together here and put software and we sell it, right? Or we'll have to move to a larger facility and grow manufacture here in US. So we picked the second choice, right? So instead of outsourcing manufacturing, we decided to stay in San Marcos. So we moved to a much larger facility. It's almost three times bigger than what we had before. But it allowed us to not only keep, but also greatly grow our manufacturing staff and number of people in software we have. So we've made a conscious decision to keep our growth here in the U.S. And that's a message that I think resonates with a lot of people. You know, it's most of our customers, if not all of our customers, understand the value of having things made here so that we can support whatever they need. You know, we make quite a bit of custom systems as well. So, you know, if the solution our customer needs can't be off the shelf, we are able to tweak and customize and put different ports here, different sources, turn things upside down to really meet the demands of our customers. So it's not a business model that works for everyone, but it's a business model that works great for us, for our culture. And we see us doubling again in 2018 and, you know, and keeping huge growth here in California.
So, Bill, you mentioned building X-ray cabinets, and of course, X-ray inspection systems are large. They're definitely equipment. Yet you consider Creative Electron not an equipment company, but a software company. Why is that?
You know, that's a good point. When we started, when I started looking at X-ray cabinets, the early days of Creative Electron were in defense. We were a defense contractor. We did quite a bit of work with Homeland Security and Department of Defense and, you know, Navy, Army, and all the branches. And the first time I saw, an X-ray cabinet, it came from one of our customers in the government looking for counterfeit components, right? And, she told me that she really couldn't, you know, they needed X-ray machines to look for counterfeit components, right? But there's nothing in the market that was fast enough and had the algorithms needed to fully automate the process. So that's when we started looking at, X-ray technology in general. And what I found was that the X-ray company saw themselves as hardware companies, right? Where what mattered to them was the physical stuff that they were selling. And I think what a lot of these companies missed is the fact that hardware is more and more commoditized. Now, I know you, Mike, you are a geek just like me. You like to tinker with electronics.
Guilty.
And I'm sure that exactly. So I'm sure that you've built many computers in the past, right? You would go to one of the electronic stores, you'd buy a video card, you'd buy a motherboard, you'd buy the processor. Remember that?
Yeah, Fry's Electronics has a lot of my money.
There you go. So that, we don't do that anymore, right? Because hardware has been commoditized. Hardware is a commodity, right? So that line for the customization line has been pushed up, right? I mean, for you to really get to the point where you have to build a PC, you really have you might be mining for Bitcoins, for example. That's the kind of PC that you're going to be customizing. In the X-ray world, in the inspection world, a similar thing happened, right? An X-ray source, an X-ray sensor, these are, they've all evolved. They are getting better, more reliable. There are more suppliers, and they are a commodity, right? We have some specialized technologies, but for the most part, these are commodities. So when you're selling a lead box with an X-ray source and a camera, I mean, you can paint your box, however you color you want, but what really differentiates your box from the next guy's box is what runs it, and that's software. So we are a software company, right? But we're a special type of software company. What differentiates us from Facebook, for example, is the fact that we have domain experts in X-ray inspection, right? So we blend professional software writing with domain experts in the X-ray, with an X-ray and a physics and a scientific background. And that blend is really what differentiates us from everybody else. And then when you talk about hardware, well, we need to build reliable hardware, right? So that the software can shine. And so that's the third leg, if you will, of that triangle to make Creative Electron a unique value proposition. So our VP of engineering, for example, give a background of how, you talk about my background of being linear to the X-ray industry. Well, our VP of engineering, Griffin LeMaster, the guy in charge of designing the systems and making them reliable, he comes from the automotive world, right? He was designing pieces and putting together things for Honda. Our VP of software development, Anun, she comes from Oracle, so a very professional software development company, right? So, and I bring the scientific expertise and some of my colleagues here who do, we have the, like Dr. Glenn Thomas, we have many years from the X-ray, the imaging, the technology. So that blend of different domain expertise, right, from the X-ray, from hardware, making reliable, good, solid hardware, and professional software, you know, and by software, I mean, knowing that not only the things behind the user interface work flawlessly, but also that the buttons where you expect them to be, right? So that it's this seamless interface with the user. So putting all those three things together is critical. And actually, companies, they in the past, in the present today, they see themselves as, you know, you just put an X-ray and a sensor and that's it. You're an X-ray company. And I think that customers can see past the commodity that we sell inside the box and really expect much more than that. And that's what we try to do here at Creative Lifetime.
So we've talked about putting things together. Some followers of our Circuits Assembly LinkedIn page might know you from the many equipment teardowns you've done. What's behind your love of taking things apart?
Well, Mike, I'm sure that this is another point of agreement that we both have. I bet that you were one of those kids taking your parents' stuff apart, right? And just to see what's inside, right?
And you know me well.
Yeah, no, I was one of those kids as well, right? At a level, it defines us as human beings, right? It's this curiosity. Why do we go to space? It's just, we got to see what's out there, right? As, you know, a child's curiosity is something that we should never lose. You know, it's something we should preserve forever. That insatisfaction of not, you know, not taking for granted how your car runs, right? I mean, pop the hood and figure out how the engine runs. Your cell phone, what's inside this box, right? What are the components? How do they, you know, we don't have to be an electronics expert, but I think we have to keep fostering this curiosity so people, you know, they're not challenged, they're not afraid of technology, right? On the contrary, they feel comfortable taking things apart to see how they work. So, much like you, because I know you have some amazing teardowns, and I'm one of the followers in your channel, we've been, we started tearing apart the very first iPhone. And over the years, we've developed an amazing relationship with a company called iFixit. And they are, in my opinion, top teardowns in the world today. We have, for example, every release of the of a new iPhone, we fly to Australia with them, and we do teardowns at one of our customers in Australia called CircuitWise. So we fly to Australia, we buy the very first iPhone that we can, we're early in the line, we run to CircuitWise, and then iFix and us, we start pinning things apart. So it's a really nice relationship because they are taking things apart, and before they do that, we do our X-rays, right? So we know how things are organized inside the phone, if it's one battery or two, how the display laid on top of the electronics, what the screws are. It's a really nice relationship. And to that, in the last teardown we did in Australia, one of the Vice channel called Motherboard, they actually had filmed a documentary about the teardown that I recommend people go take a look, and it really shows how, you know, the excitement of being the first one to open something and investigate you know, what kind of batteries they're using, what kind of processor, how the display is mounted. You know, iPhone 10, for example, has this really fascinating set of sensors on the top, you know, to do the face identification. So at the core, Mike, teardowns are all about learning, you know, having satisfaction of opening something, seeing how it works and understanding how it works. And it's also a great way to give back to our community, because all the information we collect, all the x-rays, all the images, we make it readily available to everyone to see in our websites.
It was some of these companies, such as Apple, it's always interesting to see how they're putting things together and how that varied from even their, you know, one generation before. There's a certainly amount of sleuthing involved trying to figure out just exactly who made what. Apple will brand some of its chips as its own, even though they don't have their own foundry. So trying to figure out exactly where they came from and what's inside is always a part of the challenge and the fun, I think.
Exactly. You know, as part of this giving back to the community, community part of it, we can, you know, if you look back, over 10 years of iPhones, right? We can see a phase delay, right, of the state of the art that, you know, Apple and Samsung use to put together their phones to when those technologies become the common normal technology we use today, you know, in manufacturing in the United States, for example, right? So there's a phase delay that can be between, depending on the technology, can be 6 months to a year before we see, you know, the first 0105 components on a cell phone, and now everyone uses them, right? So by looking, by tearing down and inspecting what a leading edge phone like the iPhone 10 is today, gives us a glimpse of how and what our manufacturing is going to be like in a year, maybe a year and a half or two, right? It's kind of looking like a little time capsule for us to gauge into the future. And one of the things, for example, that we saw first on the iPhone 10, and I foresee in about a year and a half, is going to be starting to be more and more commonplace here in the U.S., is the substrate-like PCB, right? Where they are pushing the trace trace widths and trace spacing to the you know, under 10 micron level, which is, you know, something that's still unseen very often here in the U.S. But Apple has been able to put in mass production, right, and making millions of these things. So you know that this you know, high-end substrate like PCBs will be trickling down to our manufacturer in the near future. So by showing people how things are built today with these high-end products, it gives them a chance, right, to start preparing and strategizing how they are going to react when their customers, for example, if you are a contract manufacturer, how are you going to put things together when your customer comes to you and requires some extremely high tolerances, right? Because the other thing that happens, once the mass production goes in that direction, it gets to find the older components, right? So we see this all the time. We have companies being pushed into ball grid arrays and QFNs because the components they used before with a larger package don't exist anymore, because component manufacturers, they're interested in designing and making components to very high volumes, right? And who's making things at high volumes? Cell phones. So you end up, you need a specific component, you won't be able to find with you know, 1 millimeter ball with the spacing anymore, right? You have to now go with 0.3 millimeter ball and spacing, which now pushes your manufacturing, your rework strategy. Everything gets pushed forward, even if you don't want to, right? Market pushes you. And by looking at this phones, you see the tip of that arrow that eventually is going to push you forward.
So, you know, as you point out, there's certainly the phase change as the component progression from generation of, to generation of cell phone and other mobile devices. One of the things that I always find interesting is the use of certain materials and their applications. For example, when conformal coating first started getting used on the microphones, you could kind of reverse engineer and from generation to previous generation and say, okay, well, they must have been having some field failures or some takebacks as a result of excess moisture. And so they decided to start dipping the board in and putting a little bit of coating over the microphone to help protect it. So that's part of the fun
exactly.
for me.
And you, and to a point where today you have, you know, waterproof phones, right? So we have, they're fully conformal coated and they have, so you can drop them in the toilet and have a phone that survives afterwards, which, by the way, is the reason why they,
right.
they do it. It's because people drop in the toilets all the time. So, yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's, yeah.
Yeah, all of.
Who hasn't, right?
Right, well, yeah, we keep an extra supply of rice
exactly.
around just for that occasion. Well, Bill, it's been a total pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for coming on PCB Chat.
Thanks so much for your time, Mike. It was great to be here.
And for listeners who want to hear more from Bill, you can go to his website at creativeelectron.com or to his LinkedIn page, also under Creative Electron. And Bill, do you have a Twitter account or anything else you want to mention here?
We do. We have Twitter, Creative Electron, and also on Instagram, where we can follow us and, you know, check what we're up to.
Terrific. Bill, thanks again for coming on. This has been Mike Buteau for PCB Chat. Have a nice day.